This is Terror House Radio with Matt Forney and Bryden Proctor.
Yeah, welcome to it. Terror House Radio, episode number 40. I'm Matt Forney, your charming and loquacious host, and the founder and editor-in-chief of Terror House Press. My co-host and producer, Bryden Proctor, will not be joining me on this episode. He is busy on a move to the Amazon rainforest. He really cares about the trees, and he's going down to the Amazon to save the trees. So he won't be here on this episode. Well, you could say he'll be here in spirit. And just a fair warning, there will almost certainly not be an episode of Terror House Radio next week for the same reason. You know, as it turns out, it's very involved moving down to the Amazon. So Bryden probably won't be here. And there may be one the week after that. I'm not sure. We'll have to see what happens. But anyway, on this show, I'm welcoming back Andy Nowicki. He is the author of many great novels and short story collections, such as The Columbine Pilgrim, published by Terror House Press, Under the Nihil, published by Terror House Press, and Lost Violent Souls, soon to be published by Terror House Press. It will be out in 1 week. It will be out, actually, no, not 1 week. It will be out this Friday, October 30th. Lost Violent Souls is a collection of short stories revolving around, well, lost violent souls. It revolves around such things as an alternate reality in which Lee Harvey Oswald never assassinated President Kennedy, a man who has an unhealthy erotic attraction to his therapist, and much more. It's very dark, grim, and also funny stuff, which you'd come to expect from Andy Nowicki. We're going to be talking about the book and other things, so stay tuned. All right, Andy, welcome back to Terror House Radio, and thanks again for coming on the show.
Thank you again, Matt, for having me on the show. It's good to be back talking with you again.
Now, the topic of the show is obviously Lost Violent Souls, which, as I mentioned in the first segment, which you didn't get to hear because I recorded it solo, will be coming out on October 30th, that is this Friday. You want to talk a bit about Lost Violent Souls, what it is, and why people should buy it, and maybe buy two copies so that they can wear one around their neck, and buy another five copies and give them to friends and family, and, you know, just talk them on the street, just singing your gospel everywhere.
Absolutely, yes. I think everyone should own at least three copies. Well, let's see. What can I say about it? It's a compilation of short stories. It has a kind of interesting history for me. These are a total of five stories that were written during different phases of my life. The earliest one, Motel Man, is actually the denouement of the collection. I like to think of it as a collection of stories that has a thematic centerpiece, that they're all about a related topic, sort of along the lines of James Joyce's Dubliners, let me try to think of another. Nine Stories by Salinger, you know, like the whole idea that this isn't just a random collection of stories, but these are all.
Yeah, it's not. It's not stuff that you just decide to put together just because they're all linked. Even if they're separate stories, they're thematically linked.
Yes, they are thematically linked, and the thematic link is the title, Lost Violent Souls, which is an incredibly cool title that I was amazed to discover nobody had ever used before. It's from the T.S. Eliot poem, The Hollow Men. And in that poem, he writes, you know, some will think of us, if at all, not as lost violent souls, but only as the hollow men, the stuffed men. And so the poem is about how, sort of like these men of modernity, men without chests, as C.S. Lewis calls them, and how, and just this sort of deracinated, kind of empty life that they lead. And it's setting up this, it sets up this opposite, notion of lost violent souls. And these are the kind of characters that every single story in the collection is about. Everyone concerns a lost violent soul. And of course, these are the kinds of characters that I feel drawn to write about. It's what a lot of my fiction tends to gravitate towards. So as I was saying a minute ago, the earliest story that I wrote in the collection is Motel Man. And that was written, like around the turn of the century, the turn of the millennium, 2000 or so, 2000, 2001, sometime around then. I wasn't really, and at that point, most of what I had written had been nonfiction, either essays or something a little longer. I think I had composed one manuscript at that point. I hadn't published anything yet. So this was sort of me trying my hand at something new. And so that was something that I wrote, I felt compelled to write at around that time. And, it's the first story of a lost violent soul. And it concerns somebody that is, in his case, he's, the reason why it comes last in the collection is he's somebody who is a lost violent soul, but who has managed, in his own, desperate way to kind of, get it together and to almost through a dehumanizing process, through the process of dehumanizing himself, making himself into like a human missile almost, which is what he becomes in the end.
Yeah, I won't spoil it for everyone, but basically the framework is that it's about a secret society that has turned the motel into like an object of veneration.
Yes, exactly. And now it's fascinating because I wrote this this story about a secret society before I really had ever investigated secret societies, before I ever became interested in, like, I was sort of interested in cults by that time, but this was before I really became interested in like high level conspiracies, if you will, and that just wasn't really something that I had studied or researched very much yet, and Freemasonry, I didn't really know that much about. I wouldn't have been able to. I probably didn't believe anything particularly scandalous about it or about any other secret society, Skull and Bones, you know, but at the same time, this story kind of presages all of what kind of where my life interest and where my research went later in that regard. But yes, he's a member of a secret society, and they have a secret goal. They have certain aims for humanity, and a way that they want to steer things. And he becomes an architect of their plan. At first he lingers in obscurity, basically lives, like a bum. And then he becomes successful, and famous and, well known as a magnate of, in the motel industry. And then that is what leads to the conclusion where he takes a radical step. He takes part in a radical, gesture that is meant to shake up humanity.
Yeah. Yeah. That's basically the, idea I got when I was reading the book. I mean, that definitely describes that story, but also the other stories, and that, these lost violent souls. And I think this was pointed out by another reviewer. I don't have the quote on hand, that these lost right. violent souls are just kind of trying to make their own mark on history or make their own mark in the world. But yes. They don't really succeed because, well, human nature is corrupt, and these people are very very flawed, to put it as nice a way as possible. You know, the most famous story in this book is the story Oswald Takes Aim, which is an alternate history about what might have happened had Lee Harvey Oswald not assassinated President Kennedy, which I think really kind of symbolizes that theme more than any of the other stories, but they all do, obviously.
Yes. No. There. I became at some point really interested in the counterfactual or the alternate history genre. I think the first thing I ever looked up on the internet when I first became aware of the internet, the first site that I ever looked up is a site called Uchronia, which is a collection of alternate history books showing what alternate history books have been published and sort of a timeline of the whole history of alternate history. It's a fascinating kind of subject for me. And there's two stories that are part of this collection that would be categorized as alternate history. One of them is, as you said, Oswald Takes Aim. In that story, what fascinated me, was the idea that, you know, we tend to think when we think in terms of what if such and such had happened, how would history be different if this had happened instead of that, or if that had happened instead of this? And in Oswald Takes Aim, I considered the idea, what if something had never happened? And there's also the story, whose name is escaping me right now, but another story, which is a Columbine-themed short story that I wrote prior to The Columbine Pilgrim.
Morning in America?
That's also sort of Columbine theme, but there was a story I wrote from the point of view of Dylan Klebold. If he had,
I know the story you're talking about. It's in The Doctor and the Heretics and other stories, which will also be republished by Terror House at some point in the future.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So the Oswald story, the Dylan Klebold story, whose name, Tears of the Damned. That's the name of that one. Both Oswald Takes Aim and Tears of the Damned are written from the perspective of what if a certain notorious act had never taken place. In Tears of the Damned, the character of Dylan Klebold, who was one of the two Columbine killers, was the story takes place a few years later. And he's a young adult in his late 20s. He's married. He has a kid. He and Eric, they never finalized their plans to shoot up their school, because fate intervened and they got separated. And so nothing ended up happening at Columbine High School in 1999. There was no massacre. There were no deaths. So it follows him from that point on. And it's a similar idea. Now, I have to say, as a disclaimer, I used to be very much of a, I'm much more of a conspiracy oriented person now. But when I wrote Oswald Takes Aim, I was still of the general opinion that Oswald was the lone killer, the lone gunman who shot Kennedy from the Texas School Book Depository on the sixth floor. And I was fascinated by Oswald because he is a fascinating character. In my version of events, in this counterfactual story, we have everything in Oswald's life going as it had proceeded up to the point where he was going to shoot Kennedy in the motorcade. But at the last minute, he has a loss of nerve, his hands shake and can't get it together. So the motorcade just passes, And November 22nd, 1963 is just another day. You know, President Kennedy goes on to give his scheduled talk in Fort Worth. And Oswald continues to be this nobody. And so the story takes place a few years later. History has taken some radically different turns since the non-death of JFK. And, so I was, in that case, I was fascinated by the idea that, a lot is contingent upon an act, but also a lot is contingent, might be contingent upon, the non-commission of an act. It was interesting to me, fascinating to me, I guess, in both of these stories, how passivity might, have consequences, as well. And so in this case, Oswald having this lack of nerve, again, in this scenario, he is the lone gunman, whatever you might think about what actually happened that day, how many gunmen there were, what was going on in the grassy knoll. In the world of the book, he is the lone gunman. I mean, the world of this story, he is the lone gunman.
It's not really about the, it is about the assassination, obviously, but it's not really about like the greater context of it. It's about Oswald, the person, and like who he was. Right.
Yes, exactly. And so, I have things, world history take a very different, direction, an unexpected direction, and, in some ways, not a very good direction, after this atrocity is, stopped from happening, just not because Oswald was stopped by anybody, but just because he couldn't will himself to do it. He choked. He chickened out at the last minute. So Oswald was always Lee Harvey Oswald. There was something very there always struck me as, and there still strikes me as something rather Dostoevskian about him. Just what I know about him as a person and the kind of life that he led and his obsessions and so forth, a kind of Raskolnikov.
Yeah.
Kind of figure.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing with Lee Harvey Oswald is that's very, Oswald takes aim. It's very historically accurate. You did your research on it. And a lot of people, I don't know how many people have looked into the life of Lee Harvey Oswald, but he was honestly pretty much a loser. Like he was a nerd loser. People know that he defected to the Soviet Union. But what most people don't know is that when he visited the Soviet Union on a tourist visa, he tried to defect and the Soviets didn't want him. And right before his visa was about to expire, he decided to slit his wrists in his bathtub. The Soviets put him in a psychiatric hospital, then they decided to let him stay. He was expecting after he defected that he'd get to, study at the University of Moscow and come on to be this big, important figure. But the Soviets, not trusting a defectee from the opposite side, sent him to go work at a factory in Minsk. And his journals, recovered, just had him just complaining of like, I don't like it here. There's nothing to do. There's no nightclubs. It's boring. I'm thinking about leaving. It's like the guy thought communism was going to be like this great glorious thing, and no, he just ended up working in a factory, which is kind of a warning for any communists who might be listening to this. If you think communism is going to lead to the government paying you to record podcasts, you've got another thing coming. You're more likely just going to end up stamping widgets in a factory somewhere.
Yep. And then he came back with Russian bride Marina, and
Should also mention that, yeah, he did marry a Russian woman, but like the first woman that he tried to court rejected him because she didn't want to marry an American. So, and some historians think that that was what part of caused him to go back to the U.S. in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of questions like that. And I just think, he's a very fascinating man of a fascinating character. Whatever he might have been up to or whatever he might have been. I mean, he always, he was he's always scheming one way or another. And short life. At the time that he died, when he was shot by Jack Ruby on national television, he was just 24 years old. Kind of a sad life, you know, from obscurity, crazy mom, there's a lot to that character. Like I said, I was drawn to him as another sort of in this inventory of lost violent souls that is part of this collection. So I wrote Oswald Takes Aim, I think sometime quite a bit later, maybe 2011, 2012. And I, at around that time, I was, I had published Considering Suicide. I had published the first edition of Columbine Pilgrim and Under the Nile. I was really kind of hitting my stride as a fiction writer. It was a very fruitful time as far as creativity goes. And so I was, that was the period of time when I think in the early teens that most of these stories were written, they were eventually assembled together, put together in the first edition, which was published in 2013, the third book that Countercurrents published at the time. And let's see. So to round out this inventory of lost violent souls, the other stories are Morning in America, which you mentioned a few minutes ago. And that story actually began as a play. It was something that I wrote with the idea of performing it sometime, getting it. I actually had this idea I don't know what I was thinking really, but I thought that somehow, some way this could get performed. And the interesting thing is now online, resources, online venues like YouTube and BitChute and other places like that, I think it could be a lot easier to make. It's definitely a lot easier to make and distribute these kinds of things. But this is on a very low level.
You and I can do a performance on Misery Loves Company.
Okay, great.
By the way, quick plug, go check out Misery Loves Company. It's the live Zoom poetry reading done by Misery Tourism every Friday. Really cool stuff. If you've got some of our writers at Terror House have popped up there. If you've got like work you want to share, go check it out. But anyway, you were saying, Andy?
Yeah, that's a good idea. So I wrote this this play called Morning in America, and once again, the people listening probably know I had a fascination with Columbine. Wrote a novel or a novella called The Columbine Pilgrim, which is now, of course, published by Terror House. And also wrote this short story, Tears of the Damned, which I just described a few minutes ago. So, and I was doing all kinds of Columbine research, and I was on a Columbine, a page where Columbine issues were discussed, and got to know some people from that page, other Columbine scholars or whatever you want to call them.
Columbine researchers. Scholars. Enthusiasts. We have some Columbine enthusiasts here. Columbine fanboys.
Yes. So, yeah, whatever you want to call them, whatever choice term you use, it all sounds a little ridiculous, but that was what we were, whatever it was. And so around this time, I was thinking there was so much that fascinated me about Columbine, and I don't want that to sound callous, because when I say it fascinated me, I know that it was tragic and terrible, but what I was, I think we are fascinated by crime. We want to know what gets into the mind of the of a criminal, of a killer, of somebody who chooses to commit a violent act. In this case, you know, it struck me then, as it still strikes me now, that there has been very little research into just exactly how Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris, exactly how their friendship developed, exactly who they were to one another. And, you know, the question of would they have been able to carry this out? Would either of them have been able to carry this out on their own? And was there something in them meeting one another that brought this out in, brought the killer out in both of them? And so they're like thinking in those terms of, you know, comrades in arms almost, you know, like, it's the usual paradigm is the lone killer, you know, it's just somebody who just flips or who just has this, who's a loner, who just decides, to send a message to the world that he hates or whatever. That's the usual kind of spree killer scenario. But in the case of Columbine, it's, you've got two young boys. And so Morning in America is, as I wrote it originally as a play, it takes place on the morning that these two high school students are plotting to shoot up their school in a Columbine-like fashion. Now they're not Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, but they're kind of modeled after them in a way, in the sense that they have this relationship to one another. They have this bond. I think, you know, it's just like, kind of like when they say, when you go to war with other men, you know, you kind of form this bond, and this, it's like this way of, you understand one another. You understand the experiences that you had, in ways that the outside world can't possibly understand. And that's, you know, I was in Morning in America, I'm trying to explore that bond between these two boys who have chosen, these two teenagers, these two alienated young men who have chosen to commit this terrible crime, this spree killing, this shooting up of their school, and the people at their school, who they hate. And so it's the entire story is, I mean, it's not really, it doesn't, it's not really a classical story in the sense of having a beginning, a middle, and end, or rising to a climax.
It's very David Mamet-esque. It's about the dialogue and the way these characters are interacting.
Yes, exactly. Well, thank you. That's a nice thing to hear. That's definitely a compliment. They're just talking. They're in a diner early in the morning. A waitress serves them. One of them is, you know, acts kind of obnoxiously, stands up on the table, recites a poem, and then sits back down. And they're both just kind of smart alecky. Their waitress is, you know, kind of had her fill of them, but she serves them anyway. So most of it is just a conversation between them, and then they leave, this huge tip for the waitress. That's where the story ends, but presumably it ends right before they commit the act itself. So it's all about the leading up to the crime, which I found, really interesting, because there's a dynamic to, you know, like, if you're about to commit a terrible violent act, you can always back out until the very last minute. And then once you start shooting, then you're committed. Then you just gotta stay with it and accept the consequences. And these are the moments just before they become totally committed to what they're gonna do. And
like, so it's the point where they can still turn back, basically.
Yes, exactly. And so what psychologically do you do? Because something must be, you know, if you have any kind of conscience, if you're just a sociopath, then I guess you don't care. But if you have any if you're somebody who was once a normal person, but who just has become overcome with hate or has become just so alienated and bitter, then something must be, it's got to be an inner struggle, right? There's got to be something pushing back against you doing what you're about to do. Maybe just a will to live, because you probably wouldn't, you're not going to survive, going on a rampage like that in all likelihood. So the story, the play originally, the play became a story, was about that state of mind that these two characters were in. I should also say that the play was actually performed in a kind of a bridged form, at where there was a school that I was teaching at the time, and at the main campus, it was something I submitted, and it actually ended up getting, I didn't direct it, but it actually ended up getting performed. It was really a pleasure to see. It was really great. The two student actors who play the two roles did a really good job. It actually was a legit play in a way. It was part of this student festival of plays that were performed at this college. But afterwards, I converted it into a short story, but gave it sort of the format of a play. And, you know, there's like stage directions. There's somebody who, like a stage manager type, our town, almost. That's a funny comparison to anybody who knows the play Our Town, which is, you know, very different in tone than this story, but still there's somebody like talking to us, taking us through what's going on. And then there's these characters talking in the diner. And so that was that's Morning in America.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the interesting things I think about the story is like you capture that these two would-be killers are both very mature and yet very immature at the same time, because the stage manager, as you put it, you know, begins the story with a monologue about like how, you know, people don't consider that the, you know, the, these teenage males are thinking about stuff, you know, they're right. Adults in many ways though, but not quite. But then right. When we see them sit down, you know, they are talking about this highfalutin, you know, philosophy stuff. They're talking about how they hate sex. But like the one of them, right. Like, you know, while the other one is talking, he cracks a yo mama joke and, you know, stuff like that, right. You know, like kind of driving home the point that, yeah, they're about to commit a grave act and they're talking about, you know, all this adult stuff. But at a certain level, they're still kids.
Yeah. And to me, there's kind of a poignancy to that. Like if I imagine that Dylan and Eric were still, you know, goofy kids, in some ways leading right up to, you know, just doing typical teenage boy kind of stuff, leading right up to the point where they, you know, became these monsters that they became in the last, hour or so of their lives.
Yeah.
So,
I also think it ties in nicely with Oswald Takes Aim, and that you kind of get a look at these characters who are engaged in these want to engage in these violent acts, and basically right. How kind of pathetic their lives are, really, you know. Mm-hmm. And you compared Oswald to you said he was like a Dostoevsky character. I don't know how much you've done research into like the history of political assassinations, but I'm convinced at this point that Dostoevsky was writing nonfiction, because it's a recurring theme. Mm-hmm. If you pay attention to it. I've been mm-hmm. traveling, obviously. Right now I'm in Sarajevo, a place that is mainly known for it was where Archduke Franz Ferdinand got assassinated, beginning World War I. I'm not too far from the bridge where it happened. But if you look into the assassination, so cool. If you look into the assassination, it was like a madcap comedy, you know, if madcap mm-hmm. comedies involve people dying. Right. What happened is that the Black Hand.
Tragic comedy.
Yeah. The Black Hand had positioned six assassins along the route of the Archduke's motorcade. Right. The first assassin got cold feet. Second assassin got cold feet. Third assassin threw a grenade at the car and he missed and he hit the car behind the Archduke, which caused the rest of the motorcade to speed up and the remaining assassins didn't get to take their shots. Then this assassin, he tried to kill himself by taking a cyanide pill, but it was expired, so all it did was make him throw up. Then he tried to drown himself by jumping into the Miljaka River, which is the river that runs right through the center of Sarajevo. But it was summer, and the river was only about a foot deep, so all he did was ended up giving himself a bruise. So it looked like the assassination was going to fail. But then what happened was that after the Archduke had given his speech at City Hall, he decided he was going to go to the hospital to visit the people who had been injured by the grenade. And the driver screwed up and didn't follow the route that the general who was in charge of the motorcade told him to take. And as soon as they realized they were going in the wrong direction, you know, he stopped the car and put it into reverse. And this being 1914, this means the car comes to a complete halt. And Gavrilo Princip was just sitting across the street, you know, just eating a sandwich and apparently barely believing his good luck, just grabbed his pistol and shot the Archduke and his wife.
Right. He intended, I think, just to shoot the Archduke. He had there was some sense of honor among assassins.
He did say at the trial that he didn't intend to shoot the Archduke's wife. He intended to shoot the Archduke and the general who was in charge of Bosnia at the time.
Right.
And Gavrilo Princip was, again, kind of fits into that mold of a character who basically had but ended up. Sorry?
I was just going to say, actually, on the 100-year anniversary of that event, like in 2014, I wrote an article, which was published then, Alternative Right, called Gavrilo Princip Automatic Schmuck. I think you can still find it. I was very interested in the whole dynamic of the thought behind what made this guy decide to do what he did and how the kind of what strikes me, what seems to me as this absurdity that this terrible kind of absurdity that this, you know, awful destructive conflict, you know, trench warfare, you know, mustard gas, all the horrors of World War One. Like, this is where this is how it all began, was with, this one schmuck in Sarajevo, who stumbled upon this, his opportunity to change the course of history. So, that's really fascinating. I was going to ask earlier where you were right now, and that's really interesting that you're in Sarajevo.
Cool. My travel decisions right now are impacted by a certain event that we've all been going through, but I would rather not talk about because we've talked too much about it entirely. But Bosnia is allowing Americans to go in, so I decided to take that opportunity. Kind of get back to the whole theme of assassins as losers. I mean, have you ever read an Assassin's Diary by Arthur Bremer?
No, I don't. I should have. I mean, you would think that I would have by now, but I actually have not.
But yeah, I assume you're familiar with Arthur Bremer. He was a character who attempted to assassinate George. Yeah, he did try to he shot George Wallace. He's kind of like the archetype of this person, because if you read an assassin's diary, his life is just like a slapstick comedy. He talks about trying, you know, failing at dating some high school girl. Then he talks about going to New York to lose his virginity at a rub and tug and fails at that. Then there's the part where he drops one of his guns into his car's wheel well and he can't get it out. Just kind of all around not obscure weirdo who ended up not really getting famous. I mean, he was briefly famous, but people don't remember him in the same way, you know, that they remember Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right. Or Sirhan.
And then, it extends to other countries as well. Are you familiar with a character by the name of Vladimir Arzunian?
Say it again. What's his name?
Vladimir Arzunian.
No, I'm not.
he attempted to assassinate President George W. Bush back in 2005. Well, a double assassination. He tried to assassinate Bush and Mikhail Saakashvili, the president of Georgia. Bush was giving a speech in Tbilisi with Saakashvili, and this guy Arutunian threw a grenade onto the podium. And it didn't go off because while he pulled the pin, he had it wrapped in a red handkerchief. And he wrapped it in such a way that the firing mechanism didn't release. So, like, as soon as he threw it on, like, you know, the Georgian police immediately saw it and disarmed it. And, you know, it didn't go off. And he did later get arrested. But looking into his life, again, fits the pattern. This guy, you know, he was raised by a single mother. He basically had no job, just kind of flitting around from short-term job here and there, and was an incel. And he's currently serving a life sentence, and he's Armenian. He's, you know, he's an Armenian. Right. He's a Georgian of Armenian extraction. But in prison, a few years ago, he converted to Islam.
Oh.
So kind of a yeah, again, it just seems to be a recurring pattern with these people.
And then there was the guy who tried to take out W with his shoe.
Oh,
the shoe chucker.
Yeah.
I can't even remember where that was. Was that in Iraq?
That was in Iraq. I'm not sure if that guy fits the same category, because I don't think he was trying to kill Bush, just give him a good whack.
Yeah. And W really dodged. I mean, he had some dodging skills on that day. Yeah, that's interesting. I guess that assassins or would-be assassins or would-be killers, would-be spree killers figure heavily in this collection. But the two stories we haven't yet discussed actually are more about suicidal types. One of them is the doctor's wager, or the poet, sorry, the poet's wager. This is about a story about a man I'm not sure where to begin with this guy. What do we say about him? He decides that he's going to kill himself, and then he has a sort of a semi-erotic encounter with his female psychiatrist, and then it's sort of questionable where he's going to go from there. Can you think of another angle to introduce on that story? I'm sort of scrambling to think of a good way to talk about it in relation to all these other stories.
Well, I mean, with the poet's wager and the wooden Buddha, you do have characters who, again, are in desperate circumstances.
Right.
And do try to make their mark on the world, but they don't do so through, like, you know, killing, like in the other stories, but have suicidal and misdirected erotic impulses, to put it nicely.
Right. Right. Now, in the Wooden Buddha, which that actually happens to be my favorite of the collection. I'm actually really pleased with how that one turned out. Not that I'm displeased with any of the other ones, but I was particularly proud of having written that one. It's like a complicated story involving, you know, two adulterous couples, an adulterous pairing that takes place between two unhappy spouses, leads to one of their suicides. In that story, I would say that the lost violent soul is actually not the narrator. That's my take on that story. Just as the, you know, it's not the only interpretation that's permissible, because, you know, it's an open-ended question. But my take on that story is that, the character, who the main the character who the narrator gets involved in an adulterous tryst with. She ends up being the lost violent soul in that story because she's the one who really takes the stage in the end. The narrator shares some of her guilt or shares some guilt in knowing what happened to her and knowing that it partly had to do with him, but mostly, of course, it had to do with a terrible sin that she committed, that she was pressured into committing, and that she never recovered from, never found an ability to forgive herself for doing. And so that story, the dynamic of that story, again, these are less sexy in the sense of being like about stone cold killers or you know big events, assassinations or spree killings at schools or anything like that. These are just about these sorts of quiet guys who are doing their best to make their mark, to make their mark in the world. In The Poet's Wager, it's from the point of view of a writer who is finding very little success and has decided to end his life. And in The Wooden Buddha, it's from the point of view of again, this man who's in an unhappy marriage because of what has happened, the tragedy that's, I don't want to give away too much, but there's been tragedy for both couples involved in this story. There's tragedy involving, the attempt to have children. In one case, a series of, miscarriages, which leads to, which leads to a person basically losing her mind and ceasing to care about life and ceasing to be invested in the marriage anymore. And in the other case, about an abortion that character was pressured into committing and felt the need to, again, in a way, rectify or to exact some justice for the commission of this act. So again, not to give too much away. And these are, like I said, in a way, these are like softer stories. They're told in a lower key and they're not, I still think they're intense, but they aren't quite as like in your face as the other three stories that we mentioned. But like I said, the Wooden Buddha, and Colette's Dream Man. If I had to pick two short fiction works of mine that I'm the most proud of, I think it would be those two. So I'm excited I'm excited to have this whole collection available again. To readers, but particularly in a way excited to have the Wooden Buddha available to be read again, and as well as the four other stories in this collection.
Yeah, I think it's interesting the way you approach this because I describe the stories as being somewhat erotic, but I mean, no one who reads this is going to get off unless you're an absolutely depraved sicko, because you're just, you know, I won't get into the details of it, but you have two characters who are engaged in or want to be engaged in sexual acts, In the wooden boat, Buddha, the main character is in part partially motivated by the fact that his wife has just completely checked out in every conceivable fashion due to her miscarriages. You know, she becomes fat. You know, all she does is buy things and watch TV. She doesn't really care about him anymore.
Right.
And in the you do have this and both of them also touch on a topic you've written a lot about male. Female therapists and male clients wanting to have sex with them.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess that I have three stories like that. I believe three. Yeah, it's well, I don't know if for anyone who's ever been in therapy, I guess it's kind of like any sort of situation. It's kind of like this, the same dynamic as a confession, or any kind of, relationship where there's a lot of, intimacy in a way, but it's also supposed to be, this, you know, it's not meant to, it's not meant to be open to the carnal. But yet there is something, I think there's, you know, like, and I'm Catholic and, you know, I'm not meaning anything blasphemous by this, but I think there is something, there is an eroticism to the confessional stall. You know, there is like, or there can be, I imagine, there's never been for me. I've never had a situation like that, you know, where I felt any way turned on while confessing my sins to a priest. But I can see how, for a priest, it could be a situation, an occasion, a possible occasion to sin in one's heart. If you have a woman who's confessing sins of a certain nature, or if you're a woman, you know, talking to this understanding man.
Well, I mean, the whole nature of that whole structure is that the priest is hearing about like the worst things that person has committed. So, you know, there's a certain element, things that a person would not admit to people under any kind of normal circumstances, unless it was to someone close.
Right.
So there's an element of trust there, and there's that element of vulnerability.
Yes.
And catharsis, achieved by admitting all of this to someone who has the power to forgive you. Though I do hear that with regards to the priests, in Catholic theology, they have something called the grace of forgetfulness, which basically God bestows upon them the ability to just kind of like forget these things afterwards. So like they can, you know, they can hear enough to administer forgiveness, and then like they don't have to, they can go about their lives, not having to ruminate about it. Well, I mean, for the good priests, I assume, maybe the bad priests are noting it down in their minds.
I don't know what it must be like to hear everybody's sins. It must be really, really something. It must be trying in some ways. It must be overwhelming, I imagine. But it's similar in a therapist setting, or a therapeutic setting, even though that's a secularized. It's kind of the secularized equivalent of what. The confessional is, it's still possible to see it as erotic. Like, I guess there's, the forbidden fruit aspect of it, because it's not supposed to happen. There's not supposed to be any, any intimacy of that nature. And yet there is something intimate about the entire situation, the entire, dynamic. In some ways it can't help but be intimate. And that's why, that's why transference is a thing. That's why, people react strongly when they're in situations it's in the nature of the psyche, to either you know, and they can react positively or negatively. They can absolutely, you know, fall in love with the person they're telling these things to, or they can, that person can become a representative of all of their bitterness and resentment. And both of those are, as I understand it, types of transference or aspects of transference. So, it is, you're right. It is something that I've written about, a few times. And, I guess there's something about, if you're wondering why, I guess there's something about that very dynamic it's alluring. It's got an allure, but it's also got a, the forbidden fruit aspect of it. There's something about that. Like, why did Adam and Eve eat from the tree that was forbidden? Because it was forbidden. I mean, so there's something, I suppose, appealing about that. It's like a, whenever there's a pull in two different directions, whenever a soul is pulled in two different directions, that makes for something interesting to observe and to report on, to catalog.
Yeah. So plus there's some women who do find that kind of thing a turn on. One of the things you kind of emphasize in both of these stories is when you're describing the female therapist, you depict them as being like attractive older women with like this matronly persona, So the relationship takes on not just a sexual aspect. There's also this kind of like this weird, matronly aspect where it's like mm-hmm. the male characters kind of view their female therapist as like a combined mother / lover.
Right. Right. There's an age difference. There's the, yeah, absolutely. And the other way around, the therapist sees the young man she's talking to as kind of a son / lover, which is even more scandalous. But I'm sure these things happen.
I mean, the closest analog I can think of, in fiction, have you ever seen, Steve Buscemi's Interview, the movie?
No. Is that new?
No, it came out in 2007. It's actually a remake of an earlier movie by Theo Van Gogh. It's really quite good. The premise is that Steve Buscemi plays this disgraced political journalist who's been demoted to the celebrity beat because he's been accused of faking sources and plagiarizing. Mm-hmm. And he's assigned to interview this celebrity soap opera star who's much younger, and like the two of them immediately hate each other, and right. She calls the interview short, and while he's walking home and like she's walking home, he gets hit by a car because someone on the street is like looking at her, and she's doing poses for him. He doesn't get seriously injured, but she feels bad for him, so she decides to go. They decide to kind of do the whole interview thing over and go up to his penthouse. And the rest of the movie is mm-hmm. them just kind of interacting over the course of a couple hours. Like they start making right. out. They confess all these horrible things to each other. It's got a great twist ending. But like their relationship mm-hmm. kind of takes on Sienna Miller. States that near the end, it kind of takes on this weird father-daughter dynamic.
Right. Yeah. That sounds interesting and disturbing and just like the best of Steve Buscemi. It sounds funny and also disturbing, just like Steve Buscemi tends to be. So, I'll have to check that out.
Yeah. Sorry, I'll let you talk. Sorry.
Yeah. So I'm just thinking: is there more that we should say about Lost Violent Souls? We've talked about we've sort of talked about all of the stories, what's involved in all of the stories, and and how all of the through line or the theme that runs through them all, and that they're all about men who are the opposite. You know, again, I'm taking my cue from Eliot's poem, The Hollow Men. And The Hollow Men was about the kind of men who are drained of vitality, who you know, don't have the strength to sin boldly, like Luther said. So this is the opposite of that. These are the lost violent souls. You know, these are the, I mean, I keep coming back to Dostoevsky, that like that's sort of, he seems, his characters just seem to embody this to me. And so I think there ultimately ends up being something Dostoevskian about, all of the, well, I mean, it's a pale imitation of Dostoevsky. I'm not comparing myself to him, but
he's not that conceited, folks.
That's right. But I do think that there's certainly a Dostoevskian element to all of these stories. I think if there's been a fiction writer that's sort of haunted all of my, or like has, had a effect, has wound up having an effect on just about every fiction work that I've ever done, it's probably Dostoevsky, and that this collection is no exception.
Dostoevsky. I've occasionally referred to your works and like the works of other writers in the same vein as loser lit, in the sense that mm-hmm. it's about the lives of losers, basically, you know, the kind of, and not like, you know, the glamorous stylized loser you might see in a movie, but like the actual loser we know, like, how they can be both very compelling and very pathetic at the same time.
Yes. Incel lit.
Yeah, incel lit. I'm not sure if that's entirely appropriate, because
it's not completely accurate, but
I mean even Ferdinand Bartomeu got laid and fell in love. I mean, yeah, it was with a retarded Romanian servant girl, but hey, he got his.
Yeah. So that's the collection. And like I said, it was originally published in 2013 by Countercurrents, and the cover was a mugshot of Lee Harvey Oswald, which I thought was a cool cover, but I'm aware that this cover that's going to be for the new edition that's coming out on October 30th, just in time for Halloween, is going to be even cooler. And yes. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yes. That's our motto at Terror House. We always have to one-up the competition.
Very good.
But definitely, yeah, Lost Violent Souls will be out on October 30th. Go mark it down on your calendars, you know, or whatever app you've used. I mean, does anyone own calendars anymore? You know, buy a million copies, et cetera. You know, we could always use the money. And it's a very good book.
Yes.
But definitely. I think it's just a nice short and sweet interview. We got everything, you know, we got covered all the main points, and we just got to leave the audience wanting more. You know, don't give them everything they want. Just a little, you know, they just want a little more. And if you want more, you got to tune into the next episode. So,
yeah.
Andy,
if you want more of Lost Violent Souls, you've got to read the book.
Yeah.
So definitely. Buy the book.
Yeah. And buy, and buy the Columbine Pilgrim and Under the Nile too, you know, which are also, Andy Nowicki books we've published.
Yes, and buy other Terror House books as well.
Yes, but anyway, Andy, is there anything you want to plug? You know, yeah, YouTube channel, blog, anything?
Well, yes, I've got my YouTube channel, Andy Nowicki, for anyone who hasn't checked it out already. It's kind of an eclectic mix. I talk about what's on my mind, what's interesting to me at any particular time. There's many and varied subjects. As far as writing goes, I do have a work that was published at Terror House recently called Operation Trigger Man.
Oh, I completely forgot about that. You want to talk a bit about Operation Trigger Man?
Sure. Well, it's something that you can read for free at the Terror House magazine page. And it's in three different segments. And it's written about essentially a case in which certain intelligence assets have targeted this one anti-abortion blogger activist type right-wing guy. And they've decided they're going to try to take him down. And the way that they're going to try to take him down is by trying to find a way to induce him to commit a terrorist act and then arrest him. And this is something that, like, this is
a classic tale of an FBI entrapment.
Yeah, an FBI entrapment. Exactly. It's, the agency is never mentioned by name, but it's some kind of, you know, intelligence source, some government related agency. And they go about trying to it's a case like a agent provocateur kind of case, but with they're playing the long game, because of course they've got the resources to play the long game. So in this case, they try to get this guy to commit to become a terrorist by having a female agent pretend to be a regular girl who he meets, and then who supposedly falls in love with him and marries him, eventually gets, you know, they get engaged and get married, you know, months down the road, and they're, you know, this is the the entire story is told from the point of view of those surveilling what's going on. So this is a surveillance state era story, you know, so everything that happens, we hear from the point of view of the people who are keeping tabs on the main character, who's never named. And, they call him our man. And then, the girl that is set up as a sort of honeypot, and they call her our girl. And no one is ever mentioned by name except the abortionist. He's the only one that whose name is ever used in the story. I did that deliberately. Eventually, the operation seems to have succeeded. They seem to have managed to induce this man to assassinate an abortionist, and then things don't go as planned, things take a different sort of twist, and then the same intelligence source tries to scramble and tries to make lemon out of lemonade, tries to make lemonade out of a lemon, out of lemons, based on, you know, the fact that their plans were scuttled and they were outwitted, in some way, but I don't want to go into too much detail.
Yes. You can go read it at Terror House Mag. I'll put a link to it in the description. Very, very good short story. Is there anything else you want to plug aside from that? Since this was the plug section of the show.
Yeah, no, I've got something that I wrote about that you can also read for free by going to lockdownpsyop.blogspot.com. It's a series of essays that I've written about what's going on right now, about what's the thing that made you go to Sarajevo in the first place, the lockdown, the title of it is The Lockdown is a Psyop. And it's a series of essays that were published at Affirmative Right. And I also read them. Each one of those essays I read aloud on my YouTube channel. But
in your sexy, commanding, masculine voice.
Exactly. But if you want to hear me read it, then go to my YouTube channel. But if you want to just read the words, then go to that Blogspot page, lockdownpsyop.blogspot.com.
Was there anything else? Sorry, I didn't want to cut you off.
I'm working on another story now. I don't know what direction it's going to take, but uh, but I'm trying to find a way to write about what's going on in the world right now in a way that that's interesting and different. And, so what I'm writing about now is, an alien invasion story. But it's really about in its way, what's happening in the world right now. And the games that the powers that be are playing with us and the kind of, psyops that are being put forth and so forth. So I don't have a title for that work yet. It's a work in progress, but I just thought I would move that.
You might see it soon, guys. You know, it's more fascinating work from the mind of Annie DeWicke. But yeah. Go check all that out. And oh yeah, I forgot to mention, you know, I've kept this under wraps somewhat because, the approval process is taking forever, but there will be an audiobook of Under the Nihil released in the very near future. If you don't want to read the book, or you can't read, or you just can't get enough of Andy Nowicki's sexy, masculine, commanding voice, you'll soon be able to hear him read the entire book for a nominal fee. You know, you can listen to it in your car, you can blare it out the windows and cause all your neighbors to think you're a cool dude. You know, you can listen to it on your phone. On your iPod, if you still use that, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, Under the Nihil Hole in the audiobook format. It's coming, I want to say soon, but it is coming. I'll say that much.
Yeah. I look forward to its arrival as well. So lots of good things on the horizon.
Yes, definitely. It's going to be a great year. Anyway, as for my plugs, of course, you can always just go to matt40.com and see the latest stuff that, you know, I've done. All the links will be in the description. You can also check out Bryden's stuff, his website, and all that in the description. And that'll do it for this episode of Terror House Radio. Be sure to visit terrorhousepress.com, Terror House Press, for all our books. You can check out our latest short story and poem publications at Terror House Magazine, terrorhousemag.com. Our social media links are in the description. And of course, every episode of Terror House Radio can be found always at terrorhouseradio.com. Terror House Radio is produced by Bryden Proctor and presented by Jugs. Intro music by Meme Extremist. Illegitimate Iron Coverandum. Don't let the bastards grind you down. I'm Matt Forney with Andy Nowicki, and we are out.